Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've got soaring stocks, expensive bugs, and economists who probably shouldn't write songs. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From APM in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Friday, January 3rd. Good to have you with us. And we're going to kick off our show today, as we do most Fridays, with a live look at what's going on in the world of business and economics called the Weekly Wrap. Joining me are Lee Gallagher of Fortune Magazine and Felix Salmon of Reuters. Hi, guys.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Lizzie.
All right, so I'm going to start with Lee because she is sitting here with me like an A student, all prepared. And I want to start with the stock market, which went, you know, up 15-year highs in 2013. Lee, look out into 2014 and tell us where we're going. It feels like we can't ride this train forever, but can it go a little higher?
Sure. Well, it can. It was a huge rocket this year. I mean, it just started and it started to go up and it just kept going up and it didn't stop. And if you think back, even the real estate boom years of the early 2000s, we blew that in the dust. So can it repeat that? Definitely not. But the consensus seems to be that the stock market will continue to rise. A lot of analysts are predicting in the 5 to 6% range. But I think one thing that has been totally absent in this past year has been volatility. We forgot what it's like to be jerked around so much. 3% gains, 3% drops. It just was gone this past year. So I think we'll see a little bit more of that.
All right, Mr. Gloom and Doom, I know you don't want to talk about the equity market. So I want to
I can talk about the equity market. I can tell you one thing. Stocks are very expensive on a nominal basis. The indices are really high. But the price-earnings ratio, the ratios are in normal territories. And what that is telling us is that American companies are making enormous amounts of money. A much bigger proportion of the total economy is corporate profits than we've ever seen before. And so the big question for 2014 is labor or workers going to get back some of those profits, in which case earnings are going to go down and the stock market will probably go down too, or are companies going to continue to be able to make these insane profits, in which case the stock market is looking perfectly well priced right now.
Well, then you've given me a great segue into my sort of favorite topic of this split between company profits and people. And one of those is where we see real estate going, because one of the places where you can see that is in mortgage rates and where real people often feel how economics sort of fizzles into their life. We've seen mortgage rates come up a little bit since the Federal Reserve started announcing its taper. So how do normal families start to see that? Does that mean that they start to see their wealth, their ability to refinance, to get some equity out of their homes, erode a little bit, Felix, and then to Lee?
The only way for equity in homes to erode is if house prices start falling again. And I don't see house prices starting to fall. What I do see is what I call a reversion to normal, where you have normal mortgage rates instead of insanely, impossibly, unsustainably low ones, where you have normal housing prices instead of crazy, bubblicious ones. And I think the important thing to remember here is that it's not actually a good thing, necessarily, from an economic perspective, for house prices to be going up a lot and for people to have lots of equity in their homes. We want houses to be affordable. We want people who don't own houses to be able to buy houses. And if house prices just go out of reach again, as they did 7 or 8 years ago, that's not actually good for the country.
I agree with that. I think we're going to see the housing market normalize. And yes, rates are going to tick up. That means it might be a little bit harder and it might cost a little bit more money for the average person to buy a house. But I think we're going to see more trading up buyers, more families and people that already own trading up, maybe less so the first time buyers. But I do think what the other thing that means is that you might see less of the quick investor buy-in of the housing market. So that will be better for everybody, I think. And I think overall the supply and demand is going to be a little bit more in balance, which means overall the housing market will have an easier time to recover.
Lee Gallagher and Felix Salmon, thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks, Lizzie.
On Wall Street today, kind of a mixed bag. We'll have details when we do the numbers. ¶¶ Over 2,000 flights have been canceled today because of storms in the Northeast, and tomorrow, big changes hit the airline industry. New federal regulations kick in, giving pilots more rest and restricting the hours they can fly. Sally Herships reports on how the industry is reacting.
Just what we need to make flying even more complicated. But these new rules are not for passengers, they're for pilots.
Under the new rule, you actually have hard stops in which you cannot exceed more than a certain amount of hours in any given duty that you're at the controls.
Captain Sean Cassidy is first vice president for the Airline Pilots Association. He says because there are so many different kinds of flights, the new regulations also take into account the amount of crew on a plane, the time of day pilot starts work, and the number of trips they take.
We fly flights that are as little as 15 minutes and flights that are as long as 15 hours.
And under the current rules, if a pilot starts a trip but goes over his or her allotted time, it's up to the pilot whether he or she wants to finish the trip or not. Helene Becker is managing director with financial services firm Cowan & Company.
As of today, they're able to go ahead and finish the trip. Going forward, they won't be able to.
Longer international flights already have extra crew. Becker says complicated schedules mean in nasty weather, like we're seeing today, airlines will be much more likely to cancel flights.
Not only are we going to see actually an increase in flight cancellations because of this, but we're also going to see an increase in pilot hirings.
She says the new rules mean pilots are going from 8 hours of rest to 9. If airlines want to achieve the same schedule, they'll need more pilots. So Becker says more cancellations plus more pilots equals higher prices for consumers.
You know, I don't know about that.
Don Dillman is with Airlines for America, a trade organization representing airlines.
What you're going to find is that the airlines are going to schedule their pilots a little bit differently.
Dillman agrees bad weather and the new rules will pose a challenge, but he says it means airlines will need to become more efficient with traffic control and scheduling. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Football fans in Cincinnati, Indianapolis, and Green Bay almost missed the chance to watch their teams in the NFL playoffs this weekend, at least on TV. According to the NFL's rules, when games don't sell out at least 3 days in advance, they can't be shown on local TV. In these cases, local businesses rode to the rescue, buying up the remaining tickets. So where does this rule come from, and why does it still exist? Marketplace's Dan Weissman asked around.
40 years ago, when the Federal Communications Commission okayed the blackout rule, ticket sales were the NFL's bread and butter. Protecting them from getting cannibalized by TV seemed reasonable. But times have changed. Just last month, the FCC gave notice it wants to revoke that ruling. Alan Sanderson is an economist at the University of Chicago. He and 8 other economists sent the FCC a memo saying, in effect, good on ya.
If nobody showed up to an NFL game and we just can Photoshop it in so it looks like they're people, the NFL would lose a lot of revenue, but not the lion's share of its revenue because that's television.
Depending on how you slice it, Sanderson says TV accounts for 70 to 80% of the money. And we're not talking about empty stadiums, so the amount teams would lose is really tiny. In fact, sometimes the football team itself buys up unsold seats so the broadcast can go forward. Dennis Coates from the University of Maryland is another economist who wrote the FCC about the blackout rule. He says the real puzzle is why the NFL even enforces the rule anymore, or why the league wants to keep it.
Honestly, I don't know why they defended it. It didn't make any sense to me why they would do that, given that the evidence doesn't show that it costs them anything.
Some senators have leaned on the FCC to revoke the blackout rule, including Ohio's Sherrod Brown. But Brown isn't ready to pick a head-to-head fight to yank the NFL's antitrust waivers over the blackout rule. That's in a bill some other senators have proposed. And I had to ask, does this mean you think Congress is even less popular than NFL owners?
Maybe you go to the midfield and you do a coin flip and find out what the answer to that would be. That might be a toss-up.
Which puts the ball, to mix sports metaphors, in the FCC's court. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
There's a new rule for Communist Party officials in China. No smoking in public. For decades, smoking was common practice for government officials, indoors and outdoors, while signing business deals, attending meetings, or doing pretty much anything. But Chinese President Xi Jinping wants to revamp the party's image. Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
The new party directive says smoking damages the image of the party and the government. So does rampant corruption. But smoking seems to be a more manageable behavior among China's ruling elite. Wu Yichun helps head an anti-smoking group in Beijing.
The leadership wants local officials to change their style and become closer to the people. Part of this is setting a good example by not smoking.
But old habits die hard. When I approach three well-dressed smokers in their 50s outside a tobacco shop in Shanghai with my microphone, one of them drops his cigarette and dashes off. The second one retreats into the shop, and the third one, Gu Zihong, takes a long drag of his cigarette before explaining the other two were leaders, dodging the question whether they're government officials. Gu conjures up party language to explain why he thinks this smoking ban is a good one.
To build a civilized society, you need economic support as a foundation. China's developed into a stronger nation, so it must take care of its image.
As Gu says this, his friend who dashed off peeks his head out from behind a wall and whispers loudly enough so we all can hear, "Don't say anything bad about the party." Gu and I both nod, the man disappears, and we resume the interview. Gu tells me this smoking ban has a lot to do with Xi Jinping's crackdown on corruption.
In China, you have high-end and low-end cigarettes. Smoking high-end cigarettes means you're corrupt.
Local officials in China have been caught using public money to buy expensive cigarettes as gifts to other officials. Minutes after Gu says this, his friend who retreated to the tobacco shop comes out with a red, shiny carton of Zhonghua cigarettes. They're certainly not the highest-end cigarettes, but Zhonghuas, which cost $100 a carton, are commonly used as bribes in China. As I stare at the candy apple red box, both men say awkwardly, "We bought these with our own money." The third man remains partially hidden behind the wall, avoiding the microphone, unable to enjoy a smoke. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up, what happens when a donor says, "Here's some money, but there are big strings attached"?
It's fairly unusual for nonprofits to want to alter the terms of a donation, but we're seeing more and more interest in doing that.
Believe it or not, this story involves bugs. But first, let's do the numbers. It'll take more than Winter Storm Hercules to keep traders from the street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average tacked on 28 points today, a 10th percent, to close at 16,469. The NASDAQ slipped 11 points, a quarter percent, to finish at 4131. And the S&P 500 was flat, ending the day at 1831. For the week, the S&P dropped a half percent, as did the NASDAQ. The Dow ended New Year's week basically flat. Automakers say they sold 1.4 million vehicles in December, one of the best months in years. And Ford says a strong December means that its F-Series trucks ended 2013 as the country's best-selling vehicles. Ford stock picked up, see what we did there, nearly half a percent. And AT&T says it is launching an all-out effort to poach customers of a rival. AT&T will give T-Mobile customers $400 to switch networks. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues factory orders for November. Haven't taken the tree down yet? There's still time. The 12 days of Christmas conclude in some regions with the Christian celebration Epiphany. And long before lolcats, there was Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. The TV show about animals and their natural habitats premiered on January 6, 1963. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Ryssdal. The leader of the world's biggest democracy says he will step down. India's Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has been in power for a decade. He will leave after elections this spring. India's growth had been soaring, but has stumbled these past few years as the country wrestled with corruption scandals and inflation. Still, Singh's time in office helped shape much of the current Indian economy. To talk about him, we've turned to the BBC's economics correspondent, Andrew Walker. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Lizzie.
Manmohan Singh has really been synonymous with India and the Indian economy for the past decade. How big of a shift is this for the Indian economy when he steps down?
Well, I'd actually put it at two decades, because things really got going when he became finance minister in 1991 at the height of an economic crisis. His initial moves were to start dismantling this very extensive system of government licensing, to start opening India up to international trade a great deal more. All that is done. So really, I think how big a shift this is going to be will really depend on whether his successor is capable of grabbing the reins, as it were, and pushing ahead with the next phase of reforms, which are politically very difficult things to deal with.
I'm thinking about when I was in the country in 2010, India was running at about 9% growth. And when we look at the third quarter of 2013, it's about 4.8% growth. That's a huge difference. Are these problems with the economy due to government mismanagement, or did the boom in the Indian economy just disguise those issues?
Well, there's an element of bad luck, I suppose. India has been affected by some of the international financial market turmoil that's been going on. But there certainly is a certain self-inflicted element to this. It does have problems, creaking old infrastructure, so roads, other transport networks, telecommunications, power supply, all that stuff really badly needs to be updated. And corruption is certainly a real problem in India. And that does impose a significant barrier to investment decisions, both by domestic businesses and by foreign investors as well.
In the past few days, Manmohan Singh has been on his Twitter account, tweeting out charts about growth in the economy under his management and different things, sort of polishing up his own legacy. When you look at the legacy of the Indian economy under his management, how do you think history will see it?
I think history will see Manmohan Singh as being the one who started the transformation, taking India away from this heavily government-dominated economy to a market-oriented system that has grown strongly and is capable of doing so for a lot longer under the right kind of leadership.
Andrew Walker from the BBC, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Lizzie.
The GED just got a major overhaul. A new test launched yesterday. It's now on a computer only, and it's more expensive. But the big change is the skills it tests. No more multiple choice questions that require you to memorize facts. There's a new focus on critical thinking and computer skills, and officials say it's going to test how workers think and what they need to know in the 21st century. There are still plenty of critics, though, and they say the GED has little value and the new test won't change that. Emily Hanford and Stephen Smith of American Radio Works explain why.
Chad Phelps is an aspiring musician in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Since I was 15 years old, I loved doing music.
Something Phelps hated as a teenager was going to school. He got in lots of fights and ended up dropping out in ninth grade.
Just me being young and dumb, you know, wanting to have fun and not even caring about school. I didn't at that age.
Now he's 26 and tired of working at Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, so he signed up for a GED prep class.
To me, what came easily was social studies, science, and reading. I didn't even really have to study for those.
He passed and got his GED.
This is amazing.
That was James Heckman's reaction when he first heard someone who dropped out in ninth grade could take a test and get the equivalent of a high school diploma.
I was actually really enthusiastic. I said, what a great thing. You save all this money in schools and so forth.
Heckman is a Nobel Prize-winning economist at the University of Chicago. He wondered if someone with a GED really had the same skills as someone with a traditional high school diploma. So he started digging through years of government data.
And I just asked the simple question, did the GEDs do better than dropouts?
The answer was no.
When it comes to things like earnings and unemployment, Heckman found no significant difference between people with GEDs and people with no high school credential at all.
And it's not because people with GEDs aren't as smart. In fact, they're just as smart on average as people who graduate from high school and don't go to college.
But people who go to high school for 4 years and get a diploma tend to have a set of skills that people who drop out don't tend to have. Heckman calls these non-cognitive skills.
Things like persistence, conscientiousness, trust, the ability to get along with others. There's a whole variety of these social skills.
Since the GED began in 1942, it's been run by the nonprofit American Council on Education. C.T. Turner is a spokesman.
Right now, there's no test that adequately measures some of those softer skills, persistence, some of those other things.
Turner says what high school dropouts really need is a harder test. So the council teamed up with publishing giant Pearson to create a new GED. Turner says the new test requires higher-level thinking.
So let's say they looked at JFK's inaugural speech, and there was a question and said, did he mean this when he said XYZ, explain in a paragraph? So people are going to have to think critically, and then they're going to have to actually write about it.
Turner says people who pass the new GED will be better prepared for college. But lots of people need a GED just to get a job.
And maybe, like I said, every time I would look in the one-ass section of the newspaper, and I see must have a high school diploma GED.
Charles Gibson dropped out of school in 10th grade. That was 1975. For years, he worked as a janitor and a security guard, but says he can't get those kinds of jobs anymore. So in 2008, he went back to school.
Okay, well, in this session, we will go over decimals.
Gibson is preparing for the GED at an adult education program in Washington, D.C. called Academy of Hope. This is a math class.
So write the following as a decimal or as a mixed decimal.
What's a mixed decimal?
Number one.
I don't understand.
Many of these students are in their 50s and 60s. Lots of them went to bad schools where they didn't learn much, says Academy of Hope co-founder Maria Hilfiker.
I know lots of people who are excellent workers and show up every single day. And meeting the GED requirements is a long stretch for them. But they should be able to make a living.
Hilfiker says making the GED test harder is not going to help employers find good workers for low-skilled jobs. It's just going to make it nearly impossible for lots of people, especially older workers, to get hired.
And a harder GED isn't likely to help many of the people who succeed in passing the test either, says economist James Heckman.
It's not that smarts don't matter, says Heckman, but it's a mistake to think that smarts are enough. He says high school dropouts don't need a new test. They need a way to learn the skills that tests don't measure. With Emily Hanford, I'm Stephen Smith for Marketplace.
The Smithsonian Institution is going to court over bugs. Yep, bugs. 50 years ago, a donor left the museum complex money to collect insects. And now the Smithsonian wants to modify the terms of that agreement. So it's really a conflict over money. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, this is an issue facing an increasing number of nonprofits and donors.
Okay, here's the lawsuit in brief. Half a century ago, a man named Mr. Drake left the Smithsonian money. Now it's about $4 million to collect a certain type of bug.
Things like stink bugs and bed bugs and assassin bugs.
That is Michael Raup, entomologist at the University of Maryland. Thing is, the Smithsonian is now basically like, we already have enough of those types of bugs. Raup says it's a common issue in science.
Usually there's lots of money available for collecting these bugs and bringing them back, but the real challenge is finding the resources to store and curate and study these things through time.
Stacey Palmer is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. She says this kind of request to change a will, for example, has become more common recently.
It's fairly unusual for nonprofits to want to alter the terms of a donation, but we're seeing more and more interest in doing that as the bad economy has put pressure on nonprofits to find various ways to get money from any place they can.
Palmer says that has made wary donors extra careful in recent years to line up legally binding documents explaining what they do and don't want their money to be used for. Winton Smith is a planned giving attorney. He says without those kinds of documents,
in many states, they have no legal standing to go into court and enforce that gift restriction.
But even with a legal agreement like a will, it's still possible for a nonprofit like a museum to modify them later.
They'll have to show that the restricted gift is no longer possible.
So, for example, if the will said the money is to cure smallpox and smallpox is cured,
and the charity will ask the court for permission to use those funds for the nearest similar purpose.
In the Smithsonian's case, they still want to use the money for the same types of bugs, but to maintain them, as opposed to collect more of them. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, Ben Bernanke took a bow of sorts today, giving one of his final speeches as Fed chair to an annual gathering of economists. He said 2014 potentially bodes well for the U.S. economy. Then things got weird. A University of Chicago economist wrote this tribute.
Ben Bernanke, the central banker, had a very shiny dome. And if you ever saw it, you might even say it glows.
Economists, we love you, but maybe keep your day jobs. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow tacked on 28 points, a tenth percent. The Nasdaq slipped 11 points, a quarter percent. And the S&P 500 was flat, ending right where it started. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yor. And Marketplace is produced by Satara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Have a great weekend. We'll meet you back here on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.